Tonight on The Download, from KNPR in Las Vegas, Carrie Kaufman. From the Boston Globe's Spotlight Reporting Unit, Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Resendi. And rock critic Jim DeRogatis. Now, here's your host, a man who is learning to fly while free-falling as a refugee, Justin Kaufman.
Good evening, all. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. A wonderful show lined up tonight to try to make sense of the world we live in on this crazy second day in October 2017. Today, what a numbing day for many who, of course, woke up to the news of what happened in Las Vegas and then continued to watch for updates, to listen for more information, to find answers to questions. Tough day. We'll talk about that. One thing we want to talk about, we got a slew of segments to talk about tonight. We'll talk, Chris Roebling and Dave Lundy will be in here tonight. We'll do Touche, as we do every Monday night. Talk about the political response to this. Of course, both sides have sort of fit right into the pattern when it comes to Democrats and Republicans. They've talked about gun control. Or it's too soon to talk about gun control. Those are the two platforms that seem to be playing out when it comes to politics. We'll talk with Chris and Dave about that, plus some other things that are happening in the world. Coming up at 8 o'clock, we're going to talk with Carrie Kaufman. Carrie Kaufman, an old friend who was a no relation. She was the founding editor, I believe, at Performance in Chicago that covered the theater world. And she took a job in Las Vegas as a host, reporter, producer for State of Nevada, which is a talk show, morning talk show there for KNPR. So we'll talk with her. It's funny because I've always kind of seen her on Facebook and I'm like, oh, she's doing great out there. And I didn't realize she was actually a Las Vegas native. But today, of course, that radio station and other news organizations in Las Vegas telling the stories of their town, not only to their town, but to the nation. And I always like to talk to people who are on the ground, who are from there, to get a better picture of what's actually happening in Las Vegas, as opposed to, I am inundated with New York Times stories, Washington Post, ABC News, CBS. Everybody's got a take on all of the facts that, of course, we want to know about. But I'd like to hear more about what's happening in Las Vegas. Carrie Kaufman going to join us in the 8 o'clock hour. Also, Scott Smith, our new media contributor, is going to join us to talk about how this has been covered and the growing chorus of whether or not we should examine how we cover mass shootings on the news. If you, like myself, were watching any of the networks today, any of the cable news talkers, you were inundated by three clips of social media that were borrowed from the deadly attack on loop over and over and over and over. Some with sound effects, some with not, some with the sound up, some with not. Animations I saw all over NBC. And at a certain point, you question, and people continue to ask this question, whether or not that coverage, especially when you're talking about the family and the person's name who did the perpetrator, if that's part of the problem when it comes to the sharp increase in mass shootings in America. They become infamous, notorious. They get their name on the news. They get talked about. Some will say that there should be some rule when it comes to media that says that the shooter should not be identified. We'll talk with Scott Smith about what that means. Also, a brewing controversy over the word terrorism and terrorists. So we'll talk with Scott about that coming up. Like I mentioned a little bit earlier in the show, we will also talk with Jim DeRogatis tonight. Jim DeRogatis, we'll talk a little bit about tragedies and music, of course, concerts. This was a Jason Aldean concert. But we'll also talk about Tom Petty, another story today that has really just kind of continued to slam the door on our hopes and dreams, as Tom Petty found unresponsive in his Malibu home, brought to the hospital. CBS News reporting that the police confirmed his death, but then the police walked that back. And for The last I heard, he's actually in intensive care, or not even intensive care. He's in a he's pulled off of life support with no brain activity. The question being, usually people don't come back from that. So Tom Petty, we'll talk with Jim DeRogatis about Tom Petty. Also, Michael Resendiz, who is from the Boston Globe, the amazing team Spotlight, the movie Spotlight, which starred Mark Ruffalo, won a couple Academy Awards, was based on the work that Michael did with his colleagues at the Boston Globe, uncovering child abuse, and not just child abuse, but clergy child abuse, and the cover-up that went all the way up to the Boston Cardinal in the Archdiocese there. We'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about investigative reporting and the need for it in 2017, so that's coming up as well. And we'll have live music, Studio 435, the North 41 in studio. What a great band. Rock, funk, jazz. We'll let them perform live in studio tonight. We could take away some of our, I don't want to say take away, that's maybe not the right phrase, distract us for an hour as we talk with them and hear some live music. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. The country continues to mourn over mass shootings, this time in Las Vegas last night during a country music festival. As of right now, here's what we know. 59 killed, 527 wounded. They're still identifying some of the victims. The shooter has been identified, smuggled in 17 guns to the Mandalay Bay Hotel in Las Vegas. ISIS claimed responsibility, but the FBI is disputing that claim. As of right now, there's no motive, no answers as to why this man broke out two 32nd floor windows and sprayed bullets onto innocent people below before taking his own life. The tragedy, this one especially, it just sticks with you. Even if you had no family or friends involved, the sheer terror and fear of having someone do this to 22,000 concert goers. It's mind-numbing. Maybe because the ritual is so normal. Maybe you've been to Vegas. Maybe you stayed in that hotel. Or maybe you've seen an outdoor concert, maybe even this summer. Or maybe you've taken in a sporting event or a rally that would have put you in a large crowd of people. There's a thin, voluntary line that keeps us civilized, sane. And when someone tramples on that line and takes advantage of that civility, it's madness. And we respond in so many different ways, some empathetic, some revelatory, some hug their families and offer thoughts and prayers, some respond in anger, talking about gun control and how this kind of tragedy doesn't have to happen over and over and over again, and some don't talk at all. It's a moment where we try to absorb all we can, we try to get answers that just may not exist. It's a terrible day in America, and hopefully one that we'll never forget. For many in Las Vegas, they're never going to be able to. And as this tragedy turns into a serious reflection of who we are and what we stand for, hopefully those awful memories don't go away. Hopefully they prevail. The White House press office got into the mix today, saying that it was too soon to talk about gun control after the attack in Las Vegas, but then went on to say that they don't want to create gun laws that won't stop these shootings. Just look at Chicago. It's, quote, they have the strictest gun laws in the country. What Sarah Huckabee Sanders fails to call out and was called out on Twitter was that the study from the University of Chicago shows that 60% of those guns used in Chicago violent crime come from Indiana, which has some of the weakest gun laws in the country. So is it too soon to correct her? when do we stop using the too soon? Now? What a day, huh? In other solemn news, rocker Tom Petty died today? The longtime singer, songwriter, and guitarist was found unresponsive, taken to a local hospital, and at one point taken off life support. There was a moment where all the news orgs were walking back his death notice, but now we're stuck with RIP social media posts. I guess the LAPD jumped the gun on the death announcement. Either way, Tom Petty just adds to a pretty crappy day. So much to say about a guy who contributed so much rock and roll. We'll talk with Jim DeRogatis later in the show. In weather tonight, unusually hot, but not 90s. 80s. We can take 80s, right? Feel like we can take 80s. In sports, it's official, or officially two games later than it should have been, but rookie Mitch Trubisky will take over as quarterback of the Chicago Bears when they take on the Vikings at Soldier Field next Monday night. This marks the end of the Mike Glennon era in Chicago. Can't wait till he opens the Glennon Steakhouse in Aurora, though. Oh, he's not? How about a noodle shop? Or a pancake place? We'll take that. Whatever Glennon wants to do is fine with me as long as he has nothing to do with Trubisky, right? I don't want Glennon near him, not with a headset, a tablet, a clipboard. Nothing to learn here. Carry on. Trubisky takes over a 1-3 team that embarrassed an entire city last Thursday on national TV. So really, nowhere to go but up. One 11-yard completion will be an improvement. But this is the future until he sucks it up for a couple games and we're all like, you know, Glennon wasn't so bad. I'd bring him back. Gosh, we really are terrible, Chicago. We really are. The Vikings are almost down to their third-string quarterback. They lost their starting running back to an ACL tear, so they are hurting. So, my prediction, you heard it here first, Vikings 31, Bears 3. Although my favorite rumor on sports Twitter, will the Vikings trade for Adrian Peterson? I guess he's not working out in New Orleans, and they need a running back, so. Wow. The Blackhawks wrapped up their preseason this weekend. They're ready to kick things off on Thursday night. They'll start the season against the Pittsburgh Penguins at the UC. Wow. The Stanley Cup champs kicking off the new season. That's what I call prime time. Way to go, schedulers. Also tells you that the NHL really wants this to be the next Stanley Cup. Nashville? Nobody wants Nashville. It's got to go, right? It's got to go. The Cubs wrapped up this season and are ready for the NL Divisional Series against the Washington Nationals. Joe Maddon said he'll announce the starter for Game 1 on Wednesday. I mean, pretty much everyone's available. Many think it's going to be the calculator, Kyle Hendricks. Others want a more traditional approach with Lester or Arrieta or an Edwin Jackson. Oh, wait, he's on the Nationals. That's just on the Cubs. Whatever the case may be, whoever starts Game 1 will also probably start Game 5 if necessary, unless the Cubs decide to bring up an Eddie Butler, try to maneuver a playoff trade to get Brett Anderson back. Just throwing out ideas, trying to be creative, Cub fans. The Nats are going to throw Max Scherzer, who was on he's on the Dusty Baker pitch count of 350 per game. Nah, they've got all next year to rehab. Remember, the Nats used to be the Expos, so there's something to remember when you keep hearing that Nats in five garbage. Yeah, well, you used to be the Expos. Come on. The Sox wrapped up the season with a loss to the Indians, and that's just okay. They actually were the fifth worst team in baseball and not the worst in their division. The Tigers get that lovely distinction. So nice ending to a pretty bleak season. Besides Abreu, do the Sox actually pay anybody else to be on that roster? No. It's pretty crazy in this day and age. So please, this offseason, get a free agent. Someone that you pay more than $2 million, right? Not a backup catcher. Don't solidify your utility infielder. We need to see. Someone, a former Yankee, an old, like a 38-year-old Yankee. Like Matt Holliday or something like that. All right, and finally tonight, Kim Kardashian West canceled her appearance at Chicago's Ideas Week. It's a week that happens in October. Here's an idea for you. Probably shouldn't have booked her in the first place. Just a thought. That's the carry out for October 2nd, 2017. Let's go ahead and use the backroom sink to wash this day away, please. All right, coming up, Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche. We'll talk about what happened in Las Vegas, but we'll also talk about Puerto Rico, tweets, Trump's tax reform. Plenty to talk about. Chris and Dave in studio coming up. It's a download. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Somber today.
Yeah, right. How was the before all that?
You know what? Not too bad. Little Aiden continued his hockey evaluations out at the Glenview Ice Rink. I am one of the assistant coaches, by the way, this year.
Oh, wow.
Poor kids. Anyway, he did well. Scored another goal. I mean, the guy's been on fire. So,
are you excited? Are you conflicted when it comes to the Penguins Hawks to start the season?
No, because I'm a dyed in the wool Hawks fan.
Yeah, I mean,
it's Blackhawks all the way. Now, I'm happy that the Penguins won last year.
I love it.
You know,
that's right. I remember this. If the Hawks were out of it, then it's okay to go for the Penguins.
It's okay.
Right.
It's okay.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché. You go right, you go right, you go left, you go right, you go right, you go right, you go left, you go right.
All right, it's time for Touché here on The Download on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Dave Lunny, and Chris Roebling in studio.
Hello.
The first fall session.
Hello.
We've started the fall session of Touché.
Yes, I feel like Saturday Night Live because it's taken us about a month and a half until October in order for Chris and I to be back on the air.
Back on, and what a day to be back on. Let's talk about this.
We're better together, Dave.
We've been talking over the weekend about what to talk about. There's a lot to talk about, from Puerto Rico to the Trump tax reforms.
Yeah.
You know, but today, obviously, that stuff took a backseat to what happened in Las Vegas. As it started off to be an emotional day in a lot of social media circles, it quickly devolved to political infighting, especially when it comes to gun control. Why don't we start off? Let's be respectful. Chris, how do you want to start Touché?
Well, this is why the word unfathomable was created, because I think it's impossible to fathom why an individual like this, who apparently enjoyed every advantage in life, who's obviously very well to do, different homes, cruises, sort of a relaxed lifestyle at an early age, you know, 64, whatever. What causes somebody like that, who, you know, by all accounts gets along with everybody, etc., to enter into a phase of preparation as he did, which results in these, you know, I guess a total of some 30, 35 guns, this suite at the Mandalay Bay, the planning, the logistics. It's horrid. It's inconceivable that an individual would undertake such a massive evil as this. And so I can't even begin to fathom that. And then I think of the families who have lost their loved ones, or who throughout maybe some of today didn't know, is my loved one still alive? OR, you know, this is just a cataclysmic, a kind of a mini 9/11. But as you say, without the political terrorism kind of overtones, as far as we know now.
You know, I like Chris, I grieve for the loss of life. But I fundamentally disagree that this is unfathomable. I actually view this as inevitable. It is what happens in a society that fetishizes guns, that says that, and the idea that it's politics, it's making it political to talk guns. Frankly, I kind of reject that, and I find that offensive, because if this man had blown up a bomb in this place, everybody today, in addition to talking about the loss of life, would be talking about, how did he get a bomb? Where did he get the bomb? Just like we did after Oklahoma City. This is a bomb, and it's going off in our society, and it's going off whether it's here or in Orlando or in Charleston. And we continue to want to put this into these political boxes that say, oh, you know, Chris earlier today said, oh, we can't talk about this. I'm like, we have to talk about this.
You said too soon to talk about this, right?
Yeah, I mean, I just think there's a reverence one's got to have when 58 people's lives are extinguished, and when families are dealing with what they're dealing with. I understand David's impetus to speak about the policy issue. So that, you know, I agreed to come on and talk about that stuff too. So I kind of would rather not. But, and you know, people say, well, when is it right? And all this stuff. And I, you know, frankly, I think it's always right. I think anybody who's running for state rep in Illinois or U.S. Senate in Indiana or governor in what, you know, Nevada, people have got to be ready for this conversation, and they've got to be ready to talk about it. I differ from David. I don't think that this particular event is ineluctable. There's something about this particular individual that led to this particular event. We've gone all these years without somebody getting up on a high hotel floor and shooting people like this. I mean, you go back to the Texas Tower shooting in the 1960s. But look, it's horrid. It's horrible. And I know Dave wants to make some points about gun control.
Well, yeah, today is exactly the right day to talk about it, because the House was scheduled to take up the bill to legalize silencers. And had there been this man had silencers on his weapons, it would have been harder to find out where he was shooting from, whether it's this mass shooting or another mass shooting. The NRA which at one time was a legitimate organization, has essentially become not just a trade association, but a merchant of death. And they promote, there was a time when cop killer bullets were not allowed. There was a time when magazine clips were limited to 10. This man had unlimited magazine clips, which are legal in the state of Nevada. Nevada is an open carry state. Nevada is literally anybody with no licensing whatsoever can walk into the state of Nevada, go to a gun show and buy the arsenal that this man had. And police can't ask him about it.
Okay, that's not exactly true.
There are some questions about whether or not there was semi-automatic, exactly automatic. So any automatic weapon
is the only question, but right. He could take semi-automatic weapons and fairly easily
and
modify
them. This is the point that people have now more than ever before. Because, for instance, it doesn't only apply there. There is a very small chance that he purchased on the black market full automatics. That is possible, especially a guy with resources may have gone to Mexico, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that is possible.
Right.
It's highly unlikely. We know he wasn't a legal automatic owner. So that leaves the vast possibility is that he got semi-automatics, as David says, and then converted them, either himself or with a gunsmith. All right. Now, this is not just Mandalay Bay. It's not just Las Vegas. It is the southwest side of the city of Chicago. It's the south side of the city of Chicago. It's the west side of the city of Chicago. And how many other urban neighborhoods where we know that folks are out there with various multi-round clips, and they are essentially defeating the mechanisms in the mechanics inside the gun so that they can pull the trigger and spray bullets. And that's how we lose little kids, grandma, the guy who just paid his gas bill and is walking, whatever. That's how these third parties with nothing to do in the gangbang wars are being killed. They're being sprayed, right? And so this is, I think, something that the gun manufacturers are going to have to answer for. Why are you making guns to which this quote fix and
this
that's
modification,
so
yeah.
can be done?
Well, you've heard so many people today talk about, and so many different pieces of media talking about, the kind of weaponry and the sound and being able to hear what came the automatic rifles that were used. That, and we've heard that most of that is illegal in this country. And a continued argument, Dave, about most of the gun crime, gun violence that's being perpetrated right here in Chicago is illegal. Meaning it's not legal gun owners that are down on the south side, shooting. They don't have a permit. They've bought these on the black market. They've right. found that they've trafficked them from other places. So how does that fit into the idea that that a tighter gun control wouldn't stop criminals from being criminals?
It's a great question, Justin. And the answer, if you ask the FBI, is so many of these criminals on the south side are getting them from Indiana, which basically has the same kind of laws that Nevada does. If you make it easy on people, they will do it. And of course they're illegal, but there's no restrictions. You go to a gun show, you buy something out of the back of a guy's truck or back of a guy's car. You talk to law enforcement, which Republicans, like to say it's all about the law enforcement. Well, law enforcement's telling you this stuff is destructive to them.
The city of Chicago, the police department puts it on a table before their press conferences, so show the stuff they've confiscated.
Absolutely. It terrifies the police from coast to coast in this country because the criminals are able to get through various means firearms that they can't compete with. And it's so, look, what I want to do, what I believe it's time, okay, it's long, long, long past time for, is to have an honest discussion of this. So part of that honest discussion would be to allow ATF to actually research and study, gun crime and gun violence in this country, which they haven't been able to do in 20 years.
I don't know what David's talking about. There's a lot of research out there. But
no, the ATF has not been allowed to do it with any federal funding.
Yeah.
This is 20 years.
Well, I there are any number of professors. I mean, there are a lot of regression analyses that have been done out there. I don't know that ATF has got to stop the bad guys. But be that as it may,
it's their job.
What I think is, the tension between public safety and constitutional rights. You're absolutely right, Justin, that the card carrying, legal, permitted, or licensed gun owners are extremely rarely involved in illegal activity. That's certainly for sure. And you're also right that some vast number, 98% of the gun crimes that we have are involving illegal guns illegally obtained. And this, I believe, is a fundamental weakness of the position of David and his buddies. Why? Because down through the ages, they have said, pass this gun control law, there will be improvement. Pass this gun control, there will be. Pass this. Now we've got to pass this one, and certainly it will be improved. And what do we get?
And it was improved under Bill Clinton when the assault weapons ban was in effect.
And South Side, West Side, we see the effect. And now, so now those guys, David among them, want to come back and say, no, no, this time we're going to get it right. We're going to extinguish Indiana, and we're going to. And the entire gun control edifice really is seen either as ineffectual or as a falsehood that is masquerading for abolition.
Well, real quick, Dave.
These guys drill hole in cheese, notice it's Swiss cheese, and then complain about the holes in the cheese. The gun laws that you are talking about were put there by your side of the aisle. It was deliberate. It was deliberate to create this mechanism. Furthermore, and this is the last thing I'll say, the preface, the first part of the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia. What happened to well-regulated? The right wing in this country suddenly forgot that well-regulated was part of the Second Amendment.
We're all for appropriate gun regulation.
Chris Roebling, Dave Lundy, Touche. We're talking about gun control, and we'll continue to come. We'll ask the question about whether or not this will be on the agenda for lawmakers and for politicians for weeks and months to come after this terrible tragedy today. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. There's other things to talk about this weekend.
Puerto Rico
was a big issue for Donald Trump, and the president will get to that coming up here right after the break. Touche, stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right, it's Touche. 312-981-7200. Dave Lundy, Chris Roebling in studio. Of course, we just talked Las Vegas. Let's talk Puerto Rico. Another story that before what happened, this tragedy in Las Vegas was
the
hot
tragedy,
off the press.
The tragedy in Puerto Rico.
In Puerto Rico, a terrible tragedy. Politically, some infighting between the mayor of San Juan and the president on Twitter. A really strange story on Saturday that didn't go so well for the president.
Yeah, I mean, look, the mayor of San Juan, who has been working 24/7 to try to rescue people and get help, et cetera, basically went on television and she said, "Help us! We are dying. We don't have enough. We need more help. We need more federal help." She didn't attack Trump personally, but because she attacked the government response, Trump took it personally, and he then launched a series of tweets to attack her personally. In a way that I've never seen. I mean, the woman is presiding over the tragic destruction of her city that she's mayor of.
Do Republicans or Trump supporters, do they say right on to the president for that? I mean, does it just seem like a political argument, Chris?
You know what? Were I president, I would not be attacking her. But this is Donald Trump. This is what you get. And, you know, he's protecting his territory. And frankly, I don't think she's as benign as David described. She's kind of a flake. She's kind of a fruitcake. She is not a very, in my opinion, she's not a very diligent leader. She wasn't.
And you conclude this how?
Well, I think notwithstanding her statement today that suddenly she remembers going to the San Juan Sheraton for a meeting, the truth is the other mayors have been very specific about all of the help that has come from the federal government, number one. Number two, everybody down there, both mayors and feds and military alike, agree she hasn't come at all. Yeah. She has never sat with the coordinating council, which is her primary function at a time like this because of the unified. Wait a minute. Right. Number three, this was a two-hurricane scenario. So they had deployed assets, then they had to pull the assets back for a variety of very serious preparation reasons, because if you have assets there, when the second tornado comes or when the second hurricane comes through, they can be destroyed. So she was manipulating and politicizing, and that's not serving her people. So I think she got as good as she gave. And frankly, I don't care.
The American politicians are Mayor Emanuel in Chicago called the response inadequate from the government. Luis Gutierrez here in Chicago, of course, also.
These are Trump critics.
Those people.
The general that Trump assigned to head up the operation said he does not have enough. He does not have enough men. He does not have enough material. He does not have enough assets on the island to do the job.
That's
this is
why
Trump's
he was
guy.
Sent there, David. He was sent there
well,
by
why
Trump.
Why doesn't he? Why so did that... Trump take a weekend off at his golf? No, sorry.
Sorry
two
I'm
weekends
sorry.
At his golf resort.
Okay, so this is where Trump derangement takes over.
No, this is where facts take over.
No, this is Trump derangement. And what you're talking about here is a horrific situation. I mean, we've gone from one to another. But our friends in Puerto Rico lost
Americans.
Yeah, exactly. Our American friends in Puerto Rico already had lost their balance sheet and their income statement. So they had no money to maintain their infrastructure. And so when the storms hit, not only are we seeing telecommunications go out, not only are we seeing electric power go out, but we're actually seeing ground communications go out, i.e. roads and bridges. So and then you have the throughput at the ports. I actually started my professional career as a logistical planner for the United States Navy. And I can tell you that there is a choke point through which you're not going to get anything. So David is misinterpreting normal statements
about
staging
know that.
Resources.
I think people know staging resources. They understand that. I think that this is on top of that, saying that the actual – and knowing that the resources are going to be choked like that, why not bring the why not do things that are going to be above and beyond, double that, because you know you have such infrastructure woes. The president has said many a times on Twitter, oh, this whole island's destroyed, this is terrible, everything is out of whack. Then wouldn't you put more on the line to help get the island up and running?
Rumor has it it's the thing that the U.S. military does really, really well. Logistics is the military thing. So the idea that we could not have done a better job recognizing what was happening to Puerto Rico.
This is absurd.
It's not absurd.
You are desperately seeking Katrina.
No,
I mean,
I'm not desperately seeking.
This is your desperate attempt at another racist rant against Trump.
Okay, so it just so happens that the two hurricanes that Trump responded well to were the white guy's hurricanes, and the one that he didn't were the brown guy's hurricanes. Forgive me for drawing a conclusion of saying, these guys are white, these guys are brown, and that's the one that he does a lousy job with.
See, that was what's lurking inside. It is another attempt. No.
It's all there. It's obvious.
It is which ridiculous.
Which mayor did Trump get into a pissing contest with? The brown one.
No.
Give me a break.
The one
Trump
who
was golfing. Trump would not have been golfing. And what did he do this weekend? What was the great thing he did this weekend? He dedicated the President's Cup to the golf. President's golf cup to the victims. Like, you've got to be kidding me.
All right. That's
it was like a it was like a bad skit out of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
You let me know when he's finished.
There it is. That's it. That's all the time
that's
we
it.
Have. That's it. Chris, you're out.
And
ding,
filibuster
ding, ding.
Wins.
Dave Lundy, Chris
Our
Roebling.
Old friend, Phil Buster.
And Phil Buster on Touche this week. Guys, good to see you.
Good to see you, Justin.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, we're going to talk with Carrie Kaufman, no relation. She's a producer host over at KNPR in Las Vegas. She, longtime editor here at Perform Inc., and she went back home to Las Vegas to be a host reporter on the show The State of Nevada, which is a morning show, public affairs talk show at KNPR. So we'll talk with her coming up. Also, Scott Smith joins us a little bit later. We'll talk about how the news covered this tragedy today and whether or not, as some have called for, both in Twitter and articles around the web, about whether or not we should really examine how we cover mass shootings, from how we identify the victims to how we identify the shooters and how we use some of that footage that's collected from social media. If you were like me and you watched anything today, whether it be CNN or MSNBC or any of the stations, Fox, you get one piece of social media that they will get allowed to use, and they put it on a loop all day. I was watching the Today Show, where they were interviewing someone today, and they did for, I felt like it was probably about 6 minutes, the same exact 15-second clip on a loop. And it was, I mean, at first it's very, I mean, it's graphic, it's new, it's something you really want to see as almost the voyeuristic sort of eyewitness part of you. But after it, over and over and over, it loses its value. And I understand the idea that they're trying to catch people who are starting later in the broadcast, but there's something very exploitative to it. And we'll talk with Scott Smith about how they do it and whether or not there needs to be some thought about changing when it comes to the coverage cable news channels do for mass shootings. Well, a terrible day for the country, terrible day for the city of Las Vegas. Police and authorities were busy updating the press on casualties and new information about the investigation. Hospitals and doctors continue to work tirelessly to tend to the wounded. Over 500, it's 527, I think was the last count. Jeez. An uplifting story that residents of the city of Las Vegas waited up to 5 hours or more to give blood. Joining me on the line, an old friend, Kerry Kaufman, no relation, host producer of the show State of Nevada and KNPR in Vegas. The Vegas native spent a big part of her career here, where she was the editor of Perform Inc., and she's back in her town being a producer host for State of Nevada. Kerry Kaufman, welcome to The Download.
Hello, Justin Kaufman. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's great to talk to you. I you know, we rarely see each other on Facebook, and I've always congrats on your job. I hate to talk to you under these circumstances. You know, talk about today for you as a producer and a host on the show, and being someone who covers Las Vegas on a daily, talk about what this day has been like for you and your colleagues.
It's actually been kind of strangely focused. And purposeful. It, you know, for us, I found out about it when I woke up this morning, immediately was like, oh, I got to go to work. And then the text started flying from other people who had just woken up and found out about it. And once we got in there, we already had our assignments, go out and report on this. It was a really nice team effort. And it felt really good to be working with people who are really professionals.
For you guys, when you're covering your city and you know it, and you know that area, you know Mandalay Bay, and you know up by the airport, and of course the performance, the grounds where the performance was, I mean, how does that help you when the whole country is trying to understand what happened in one particular area of the city?
Well, it helps us because we know it helps us more because we know the people who are speaking and who are making the decisions and giving us updates. And so we have our resources, so we can get a hold of the people because we've been talking to them all year. That's the main thing. We know where Mandalay Bay is. We know where this concert was. There are other concerts that were in town. Life is Beautiful was just in town this past weekend. There are reports, although the sheriff would not confirm them today, that the shooter was casing Life is Beautiful over the weekend, where a number of, which attracts, I think, kind of a younger crowd, kind of a teenage crowd, more than this one does, although I do know a number of teenagers who have been shot seeing this concert last night.
For you guys, I mean, the big story, of course, in Las Vegas, the aftermath is the hospitals, and you know, listening to one of the hospital administrators on the line on NPR, where they talked about when you had the woman who ran people over on the Strip a couple of years ago, 17 or 18
right.
people were brought into the ER. In this case, to have this many people coming into the hospitals, it's not just unprecedented, it's unthinkable. They just don't have the resources to work on so many wounded at one time.
Right. People were in the hallways. People were being tended to in the parking lots if they didn't have life-threatening injuries. I saw social media from one nurse at a hospital who said that over 200 people had come in. And it was the most horrific thing she had ever seen. And they were just doing their best. They called doctors in from out of town to come help. Every surgeon, every plastic surgeon in this town was performing some sort of surgery. You know, they just brought everybody in. If you know how to do surgery, come on in and do this.
You know, when we talk about the demographic of people at the concert, and this has been talked about a little bit on the national media, but did the concert draw from the Nevada area? Was it tourism? Like, how does it sort of break down locally on who was at this Jason Aldean concert?
Well, you know, know what? I can't give you like numbers, percentages.
No, yeah.
I'm sure a fair number of people were from out of town. This was a big, festival, multi-day festival that people came here for. But there are a lot of people in Las Vegas who enjoy these various festivals and concerts and what have you, who live here. It's one of the perks of living here. And, you know, my kids know some people who were there. They know people who were shot and who are in the hospital now. We know people who go to these concerts on the Strip all the time and go to things like the hockey arena is right there on the Strip. Mm. So people here in Vegas, we enjoy stuff. And I would say there's a decent percent of people who are locals who were there.
Carrie, when you, being someone who covers Las Vegas locally and have this happen, it's such a mass tragedy that takes on an international, it's an international news story, it becomes covered from all over the world. When you turn on the television set and watch how the nation is covering this story, are they accurate? I mean, are people getting the story?
I have no idea.
You have no idea?
I have no idea. I have not had a chance to watch TV.
There you go.
It's been that kind of go day.
Or any of the news, but I understand what you mean, yeah.
I've seen some stuff on Facebook, but it's mostly been people who are here in Las Vegas kind of checking in, sharing information with each other, what have you. I have not watched TV. So I just saw something about the BBC covered this really well, and I was like, wow, I wonder how they covered it. I haven't gotten a chance to even listen or look.
What is, from your vantage point as a producer at KNPR, what kind of stories are you looking for at this point? I mean, with so much news coverage on this tragedy, what are the things that are important to the people of the city of Las Vegas?
Well, the first thing is we wanted to get out the facts, right? We wanted to get out where you can go if you're looking for your loved ones, and we were able to send people there. There was, at the beginning, there was this call for blood donations, and I think you just said this earlier. People were around the block at blood donation centers until the blood centers had to take appointments. You can't really give blood now until next week, which is great. We wanted to be able to tell people not to come to the hospital to visit their loved ones because – or they're not their loved ones, but their friends, because the hospital was probably inundated and only letting immediate family in. So we just needed to get the facts out to people. There's also been a 521 a GoFundMe page,
right,
set up so that we can pay for people to come in to see their loved ones, so that we can pay for some of these funerals and help people out after they've been injured. And over $1 million has been donated thus far in one day. So we're trying to get those things out and just kind of get basic facts out, like, how many weapons he had and what did they find in his house in Mesquite and what are they finding in his house in Reno and who this guy was and, those kinds of basic things that most journalists are looking for.
How is Las Vegas tonight? I mean, as Sam Panayotovic, who's one of our guys, is in Vegas, and he talked about this morning, there was no activity on the Strip. Where are we with a town that never sleeps in the wake in the aftermath of this tragedy?
I can't tell you what the tourists are feeling, but I can tell you that the locals are feeling pretty close to one another. It becomes a really tight-knit community when something goes wrong, and it's a pretty big community here. There's 2 million people who live here permanently, and so we're feeling kind of deflated. We're feeling incredibly sad, but we're also feeling like we have people that we can talk to. We have a community here that we kind of revel in. So that's the silver lining on this.
Yeah. Carrie Kaufman, the former Chicagoan who worked here in town for a long time now, a host producer at KNPR in Las Vegas with the show State of Nevada. Carrie, thanks so much for checking in with us and letting us here in Chicago know a little bit more about what's happening in Las Vegas. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Justin.
October 9th, Monday Night Football's on WGN-TV. Bears-Vikings kick off October 9th at 7, following WGN-TV Sports. Monday Night pregame at 6:30. Bears on WGN-TV. And it'll be a Trubisky game, right? Wow, we don't even have a chance. Chicago, what a day from this and Tom Petty. It's amazing that in Chicago, such a sports town, that the announcement everybody was waiting for and Mitchell Trubisky becoming the starting quarterback for the Bears is relegated to the back page, which it may be the right thing. It's a sports story. I think far too often our sports stories become our main stories. But
that's what John Fox was thinking. slip it out, and then when people finally pay attention next Monday, they're like, hey, what's happening?
Right. Well, Carrie Kaufman, great to hear her voice. She was on. She's performer, performing editor and founder for. I mean, she left probably 2-3 years, maybe longer. I'm losing my mind how long it's been. But she was a real advocate and a strong voice for the theater community. We used her. She did great reporting back in 2000 on the strike when they had the. After strike, or SAG after strike. But I remember that being what those issues were, and used her a lot to talk about those kind of things. But she did mention in the Las Vegas piece, and that what I really wanted her on to talk about was the Las Vegas community, not the tourists and not the people that come through, but the community that lives there. People always forget that the Strip is not unlike the Mag Mile here in Chicago. Nobody really lives on it. There's a whole thriving industry and community there, but that's their industrial area, or that's where their business is at. There's a huge population in Las Vegas that does not live or die based on, you know, what happens on Las Vegas Boulevard. And to hear her talk about that community being affected, and for them to come together and for it to find strength and closeness, I think is how she said it. It's great to hear, and I think that's probably what all of us want right now, is that sort of strength and closeness, something that, you know, as these events happen, and they happen more often than we would ever imagine, to be overwhelmed with the news that continues to just, you know, go through our social media feeds, you're looking for some sort of closeness, and some find it in, you know, in that space and social media where they can share their feelings and sort of give digital hugs. Others, like I said, some find it in anger. And you know, I had a hard time today on social media because it was just nonstop political statements from wherever you stand. The political statements and the arguments that were happening were even more vicious than usual over guns and gun control and whose fault this is. And quickly we moved on from this being a humanitarian or emotional, that looking for that strength and closeness, to almost strength in being right. And again, I'm not saying that because I don't want to discount or disrespect anybody's point of view or any argument that's being made. And there are some really great arguments being made on social media, but it is really hard. I'm sure I'm not alone to be reaching out to find something to emotionally connect to, and being faced with that. And it's hard. So, yeah, I think tonight, if you have the ability to think positive thoughts and possibly find a way to exercise those positive thoughts in some form, whether it be on your social media platforms or to a loved one that you haven't talked to or what have you, or that you talk to every day. My friend Tim, who I've known for years, he said this morning before he told his 8-year-old she was going to school and she didn't know anything about it. And he, you know, in this crazy world, he hugged extra long. Like he did, instead of like see you after school, he hugged 10 seconds instead of 3 seconds or whatever. And I thought that was a nice gesture for his family and how he wanted to sort of pass that on. So anyway, coming up, we'll talk with Scott Smith. He's going to join us, our new media contributor. I'm fascinated about this argument we continue to hear about whether or not there should be some sort of roadmap or at least some examination of whether or not we are covering mass shootings in the right way. I can't tell you, this is the I feel like we hit the tipping point today. I saw more and more on social media than I ever have before that the way that we are consuming news and the way that it's being presented to us needs to be examined when these mass tragedies happen in the United States of America. So we'll talk about that, also about defining words and the words that are chosen by the news and the media, terror, terrorism, things of that nature. So we'll talk about that coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up in a 9 o'clock hour, Jim DeRogatis is going to join us. Talk Tom Petty. Also talk about, it seems that musicians, Jason Aldean joins a very exclusive club of musicians who have been on stage during big events like this. The guys in Paris, the Eagles of Death Rock, is that what it was called? Eagles of Death Metal, sorry. Jason Aldean and some others as well. You can go through history. We'll talk about that. But also Tom Petty. And, obviously conflicting reports about the L.A. police today confirmed that he was dead. And then they walked that back. The last reports were that he was unplugged from life support and that there was very little to zero. I think it's zero brain activity. This was the TMZ report. So Tom Petty, we'll talk about Tom Petty with Jim DeRogatis coming up here. And 9:30, Michael Resendiz, he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the Boston Globe, part of the Spotlight crew. The movie Spotlight was based on. So we'll talk with him about his career and about that story. All that coming up a little bit later in the show. Well, as we've been talking about, we've kind of been teasing this out. Really interesting today. I mean, I guess we have to ask the question. Is it time to change the way that we, the media, cover mass shootings? Because today on WGN, CNN, MSNBC, NBC, we follow the same playbook on the shooters, the victims, the names, the information, the investigation, everything that goes into what usually would be said during a investigation or a news report. And there's some that say that, and there's research that's provided that will say that actually can cause copycat situations and also just in general adds to the basic, I don't want to say distrust is not the word, but maybe ad nauseum of cable news, where one 10-second social media clip from the event is shown on a loop for 7.5 hours. That it just becomes almost so difficult to watch. So and also word choice. There's so many things that go into it. So tonight, joining me on the line, Scott Smith. He's the editorial director over at Teamworks Media, and he's our new media contributor here on The Download. Scott, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, Justin. Thanks for asking. It's a garbage day, but maybe we can go through some of the garbage.
Well, I mean, there's two points here that I seem to get hung up on. One is just the idea that studies and research show that the way that the media has delves into and tries to deliver the information about the investigation, the shooter in question, is not necessarily great because there is a copycat phenomenon, the idea of notoriety, infamy, the idea that people do this to get their name on the news. And then there's also the side that I just talked about, that there is this ad nauseum where you get to a certain point where there is no information, yet they continue to scroll the same things and show the same images.
Right. And, you know, I think that's you cited as two things that they kind of dovetail with each other. I mean, we've seen, you know, whether it's the FBI in a 2014 report that looked at 13 years of shootings from 2000 to 2013, or a study in New Mexico from, I believe it was 2015, and then a following study from, I want to say Arizona University.
Arizona State, right.
That Arizona State that said that all looking at the what they a lot of these studies refer to as the media contagion, which is looking at how much particular shooters are either influenced by, and they measure that by, you know, whether they've had clippings of former shootings or previous shootings, or whether they've, you know, mentioned the methods used, or whether they've just, you know, flat out tried to, you know, achieve the same ends. You know, we've seen that this kind of contagion happens, and the effects are over a couple of weeks. And so they looked at these patterns and said, you know, there was usually a two-week following period where you had these copycat syndromes. And we've seen something, you know, I think there's about 275 days so far this year. And, you know, there's been just about that many mass shootings, which they usually define as three or more people. So, you know, you look at these studies, you look at the pattern of shootings, and it does seem to back up that idea that it is the fact that somebody who is frustrated with life, who's angry at a person or a group of people, looks to make a statement and says, I can basically grind an entire media ecosystem and large parts of people living their lives to a halt if I do this.
And it's such a catch-22 for businesses in the business of media, because I would just assume that ratings are through the roof. We want answers to these questions. We want to be able to see or hear or read about what happened, and we want a full picture. We depend on these reporters and broadcast units to tell us everything. So we're constantly checking in, I would assume, and that constantly means that they're being viewed, and that means that they're getting more ratings, and that means that they're able to pass that on and to more advertising. I mean, there's a cycle there that, you know, if the audience wants it, why not give it to them?
Sure. I mean, but this is your second point, right? So we were getting these when this news breaks immediately, which is when most of the attention is on the situation. We're usually, because of the nature of breaking news, we're usually getting incorrect information. And that's not the fault of any particular news outlet or bad reporting or bad journalism. It's just that the nature of these kinds of events, as they unfold and as police are sorting through what is real and what is not real, false information ends up getting out there. And this is not a fake news situation. It's just the way that these situations unfold. But and that happens within, you know, days even. I mean, the most well-known and probably most well-studied example is Columbine. And if you've read Dave Cullen's book, a lot of the myths around, you know, that these guys were loners and they were bullied or that they were members of the Trenchcoat Mafia, these were all things that we feel like we know right about the Columbine shooting. But once you actually dug into the facts and once you actually did the research, which took years to really uncover the truth, it turns out that that's not really true. And so if we're really, as media people, we're trying to get the information out, the actual worst thing we could do would be to take certain pieces of information we're getting at the very beginning and go over and over and over them and keep trying to dissect meaning out of them. Because it turns out that our initial knowledge about these kinds of crimes in particular is usually wrong, which is usually another good example of why we shouldn't overreport things like the photo and the name of the shooter and all this kind of stuff, because oftentimes that's the least helpful information to be providing people.
Yeah. And I just wonder, though, there has to be, if there is an actual formal examination, someone comes in who's the genius and is going to consult all the cable news channels and the newspapers and the radio stations and everywhere in between to say, this is the right way to cover mass shooting. What would that look like? And how would that also look? I mean, there'd have to be a thing to say, and it will retain viewership. It can't be.
I think it's really easy to do this if you are a print-based reporter, and I don't mean that in actual paper. I mean, if you are publishing online or if you're publishing, you know, text and articles, it's an easier way to do that. But if you are television, you depend on imagery, and you can only cut back to the, you know, news panel so many times. And it would require a completely different way of approaching how we report TV news. And it would perhaps mean that the folks that depend on hours and hours of continuous coverage would have to find some other more likely more expensive programming in order to deliver the same kind of ratings. So it would require a complete change in the way we approach news, but we'd probably end up with more actual factual information out of the deal.
Scott Smith, my guest tonight, our new media contributor here on The Download and also the editorial director over at Teamworks Media. The other part today, and I saw this a lot, obviously what we see both on social media and our feeds has almost become to a lot of people the news that they receive. I haven't even talked about that. The idea of posting articles and also delivering it with commentary is in many ways how Americans get their news today. They follow it. They follow a friend, that kind of thing. Today we saw just a lot of, like you said, a lot of misinformation, but also a lot of commentary, a lot of subjective approach, great tweets that are hilarious, but, you know, not necessarily accurate. And then there was this issue that I saw pop up on social media about whether or not we call this terrorism. And this was something that the news organizations, no one went out of their way to call it terrorism, but there were a lot of people online that were in commentary and protests to that saying, you won't call this terrorism, but you'll call something else terrorism. There's race involved, you know, things of that nature. Where do we stand on the idea of the word choices used by the news today on this tragic day?
Yeah, I mean, this gets back to how we report and how we attach importance to things. I mean, I think, you know, I've been one of those people, and I've worked in news organizations that have advocated for using the word terrorism instead of mass shootings, because it puts the emphasis on what's trying to be accomplished rather than putting the emphasis on the gun. It actually puts the focus back on the human being that's perpetrating this crime. And there are some folks who really things because it means in part that we take this more seriously. We actually put the kind of resources and both financial and legal against these kinds of situations and seemingly prevent them from happening in the future the way we've, you know, really done with terrorism. Now, you could flip it around and say, you know, all of the things that we've done to combat quote-unquote terrorism have maybe helped us fight terrorism better, but it has certainly had an enormous cost, both in terms of the privacy of people, the human rights of people, the civil rights of people. And so on another hand, you can come back at it and say, if we start to take mass shootings in that same framework, we're actually going to make our society significantly, on some levels, less free, but also less like the society we actually want. I think ultimately this term is about let's actually bring down the level of rhetoric and hyperbole that is around what we tend to call terrorism, which is usually any kind of act of mass violence that has a political angle to it and has often a foreign connection, which is how, you know, everybody from the FBI to the Department of Defense to, you know, NATO to the CIA tends to qualify terrorism, but also then raise the level of discussion around mass shootings and say, let's actually really look at what's causing some of these things. Let's look at the copycat factor. Let's look at, you know, maybe mental health, but let's also look at how easy it is for somebody to stockpile an enormous amount of weapons in a casino hotel room and fire on a bunch of people at a concert. If we're not actually talking about the real reasons why these things are happening, we're not actually calling things what they are, we're never going to find solutions for
it. Is that the job of the media, especially on day one, to sort of look into why someone would do this or why this is happening in our society and how to prevent it from happening again? Or is it nuts and bolts? Is it who, what, when, where? Well, this is what we know, and we'll let the lawmakers and citizens of our country figure the rest of it out.
Well, you know, I mean, what we often say is about journalism is that the nature of it is about comforting the afflicted. You know, at this point, we are all afflicted by mass shootings and gun violence, and there is some level of comfort in being able to separate reality from, you know, fake conspiracy theories and from the kind of fake rhetoric that you often see from the NRA. And if we're not actually looking at, as media organizations, if we're not actually looking at the real causes of these incidents, then I think that you're no longer in the business of providing news or information. You're just becoming an entertainment network.
Fascinating. Scott Smith, the editorial director of Teamworks Media and our new media contributor here on The Download, joining us tonight to talk a little bit about how the media covered it and whether or not we need to rethink the way we cover mass shootings in the future. Scott, great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us, bud.
Thanks, Justin. Take care.
Well, it's amazing to see right before our eyes the story that Tom Petty has getting better. I know. I mean, there was reports earlier in the day that Tom Petty had passed away after being taken off life support following cardiac arrest. They found him unresponsive at his Malibu home. All of that's true. And he did get pulled off of life support, but he's still currently alive. What I saw on Facebook, and I don't know if this is accurate, but I saw somebody posting that they had upgraded from whatever to serious condition. Like, that's a better condition than life-threatening. But again, and I'm getting that off of Facebook, but...
I know his daughter used Instagram to post a somewhat vicious accusation about against Rolling Stone for printing that he was dead.
You know, I've seen this and I've stopped myself from writing comments on friends' posts about it because everybody wants a knee jerk to the fake news. Oh, they screwed it up, and I'm like, the only reason this story is where it's at is the Los Angeles Police Department. Put on Twitter, last time I checked, it's not off the record. They put on Twitter, they confirmed his death.
Mm-hmm.
That is why CBS went with it. It's not like they're just like, I think, let's do it. Or TMZ. And TMZ at the beginning, actually, everything was accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't necessarily, this isn't a story for all the people who really want to get at the media. Oh, you know, I can't believe the media.
Yeah.
The L.A. Police Department put it out and then walked it back. Sorry, we don't actually comment on that. We're not in this part of our investigation, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know who did that or what the problem. But the point being that, you know, it's easy to kind of, yes, media makes a lot of mistakes. But what are they supposed to do in that situation? If the Los Angeles Police Department confirms a death on Twitter publicly, it's going to go like haywire, right?
Well, but therein lies the problem, guys. We so often now in this day and age of social media do not do our due diligence.
Right.
So LAPD tweets something out. We immediately run with it. Then we blame the LAPD. Did anybody think to call the hospital and get confirmation from them? Did anybody think to call the coroner's office, get confirmation from them?
I want to understand, Rob, though, because there was a tweet, but then CBS says they did that. CBS said that they went to the police department or they got confirmation from the police department. Maybe that's what they meant. They just pulled it off Twitter. But I read a thing where they actually had the police department confirmed it, and then the police department rolled it back. Regardless, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's the old saying that, you know, your mother says it's true, you get a second source. And I've had that happen to me many a time where I've been talking to my wife. And she'll tell me something she read, and I'll be like, and then I'll say it to somebody, and they go, that's not true. And I'll go back and like, what? And she's like, oh, I was just making it up. Or not making it up, but, you know, I don't know. I read it on Twitter, and I'm like, what? I trusted you. It happens all the time. Yeah, I said what you said. And she's like, I'm not a source. And I'm like, ah, oh, God. Mm-hmm. All right, we'll talk with Jim DeRogatis coming up about this Tom Petty fiasco.
Right.
I mean, it's a good fiasco.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not sure he's out of the woods. I think this might be delaying the inevitable since he was considered to be brain dead, taken off of life support. He is still alive after that ritual. We'll talk more with Jim coming up.
I want to know what to do with my Tom Petty meme that I've created. You know, nice picture. I have it ready to go.
That's it. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. With you till 11 o'clock tonight. Coming up, we're going to talk with Michael Resendiz. He is the longtime reporter for the investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. His team, Spotlight, of course, was the team that brought on or took on clergy sex abuse and the cover-up by the Boston Archdiocese. We're going to talk with Michael Resendiz about his role in that, and a role that he was played by Mark Ruffalo. Great as that, huh? In the movie, the Academy Award-winning film. He's going to be doing a lecture at, it's called Spotlight, and The Man Behind Spotlight. I forgot the name of it. I'll get it up here. But anyway, he is going to be at the College of DuPage at the Max Center tomorrow night doing a lecture slash speech about his life in journalism, his career, investigative reporting, Spotlight, everything in between. So he'll join us tonight to give us a preview of that speech. Also coming up, the North 41 will be in Studio 435, the live blues, rock, jazz, funk, soul band. This is a great band. Love their stuff. And we will be having them live in studio tonight. So they'll be my guest then. Well, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, Tom Petty, what a day. If you already were in a position where you were mourning the tragedies of the day, Tom Petty came along in the early afternoon. It was discovered that he was found unconscious in his Malibu home in cardiac arrest. He was pulled from life support. Reports of his death surfaced. CBS News went with it, the LAPD confirming. That since has been walked back. Tom Petty still alive in the hospital after the alleged pulling of the life support. On the line with us, Jim DeRogatis, the famed rock critic here in Chicago, who is one half of the great show Sound Opinions, which you can hear all over the country on public radio. Jim DeRogatis, thanks for joining us, bud.
Yeah, hey, Justin. What a surreal day.
What a surreal day. And it gets, I mean, even more so with Tom Petty. I mean, when we talked earlier in the day, you know, I was thinking straight obit for him to still be alive. I mean, we still can talk about his legacy, but so surprising in this day and age when we usually, when it comes to deaths, get it right.
Yeah, you know, I think that this crazy, insane rush to be the first to tweet, to be the first to get something up online, I mean, if we haven't seen enough evidence of late that it's doing a disservice to journalism, here's yet another example.
Yeah. Well, Tom Petty...
You know, I think the most heartbreaking thing I read was a furious rant by one of his two daughters. He has two daughters and a stepson at Rolling Stone magazine, ranting and raving at them for being so eager to bury her father, who's not dead yet. And he may, you know, he may pull through and he may not. But I mean, you know, my dad died in July, and I got four calls over the space of 3 or 4 weeks from hospice care. And every time it was like, you know, 48 hours.
Yeah, right.
You know, and that happened four times, you know, and many of us have family members that we've lived through something like that with. I'd hate to see somebody I loved buried prematurely.
Especially in this way where it's all on the internet and Twitter and Facebook and everywhere in between.
Yeah, you know, and the whole story originated with TMZ. I mean, oh my God.
But they got the story right in the way that he was rushed to the hospital. They actually, surprisingly, did
it's
not.
True. They did not report he was dead.
Right.
Unlike CBS, right.
CBS. You know, Tom Petty is amazing to me, and I don't think I've ever seen this, Jim, where someone who's still alive, you know, because everyone just believes the news that's out there. I mean, there was just a rush from celebrities to everybody in my Facebook feed and Twitter to talk about Tom Petty and his legacy and what he means to them. I mean, to think about what Tom Petty does mean as a musician to so many different people of many generations.
It's amazing. I think, Justin, he's rare in the rock star stratosphere for being the sort of guy who can sell out the United Center or Wrigley Field and be so down to earth and accessible to people. You know, he was not a garrulous person, but you saw him in interviews, saw him in that 4-hour documentary, heard the music, and heard someone genuine, someone authentic. My favorite Petty moment, he spent about 2 hours with Greg Kot and me, the entire length of the original Sound Opinions on XRT. He was doing that week-long stint at the Vic in the late 90s, where he was playing blues songs, music he grew up loving. and he just hung out with us. And there was a great moment where suddenly, you know, so Cot and I, who were pretty, you know, pretty jaded, we've interviewed a lot of rock stars, we're geeking out that we're with Tom Petty, and Petty was recalling a wonderful day he spent with one of his heroes who became a friend, driving around on his bulldozer on an island in Hawaii with George Harrison, touring George's pot farm. All right? And on a bulldozer. And he was like a 17-year-old kid talking about hanging out with George Harrison, and Cot and I were feeling like 17 years old. We're hanging out with Tom Petty. So there was a real accessibility there. And I think journeyman is a word that sometimes is tossed off as someone who's just like workaday, but not extraordinary. You know, obviously the art was extraordinary. I saw a tweet from somebody who said, you know, my favorite Tom Petty song is whatever one's on the radio now.
Yeah.
Because there are dozens of incredible songs. But he never had that, you know, he did not have that Jagger attitude, that Sir Paul McCartney attitude. He was almost, you know, in a stratosphere that was similar, but he never acted that way. He was always the kid from Florida playing in the bar band.
You know, he, and you mentioned that four-hour documentary, you know, to think about him and being a musician at that time in the late 70s where he was making some unbelievable music, whether it be Refugee or American Girl or any of that stuff. You know, he has lived so many different lives in the way that that's much, much different than Free Fallin' or Learning to Fly or any of the stuff, The Last Dance with Mary Jane, that came out even more recent. I mean, he has really found himself almost like a chameleon in a way that he can still be able to write the great rock and roll song, but appeal to so many different generations.
Yeah, you know, somebody tweeted an interview I did with him in 2009. And, you know, it's one of those interviews I'd forgotten. And it was a quote that I wouldn't have remembered, but people have been passing it around on the net, where we were talking about, you know, this notion that everything that could be done with two guitars, bass, and drums had been done. And he said, you know, the thing I'm proudest of in my catalog is that the song could have been written in 1967, or it could have been written in 2007, and I would say now 2017. There's a sort of timelessness to his music. I think it's his great strength, is that it was not prone to fads or fashion, and it was just great, you know, gutsy rock and roll in a way that I think, you know, I'm not a Springsteen fan, you know that, we've had this fight, but I think if you want to look at the real American rock and roll, I mean, I think that's Petty. Not as much a Bruce Springsteen.
To me, they fall in a very similar category. It might be that they were at the same time in that sort of mid to late 70s creating the music of soundtracks. I mean, we'll know those songs forever. But Tom Petty also comes from it in a way that it almost felt like he was the one-man band, even though he had the Heartbreakers and everything around him. When you think about Tom Petty, he was much more of a singer-songwriter. And all of that can be said about Bruce Springsteen as well. But with the E Street Band and everybody around him, he felt like there was so much more ensemble, where Tom Petty was just the guy who came in and, I wrote this song last night, let's put it down. Like, it's a little more like sort of simple, if you will, push to,
yeah,
to
well,
rock
like
and roll.
I said, like I said, no attitudes. You know, you felt like you could have a beer with this guy. I think the other thing that's really important to note about him is how hard he fought for his fans throughout his career. You know, his major label recording career almost ended because he was not going to back down, in his own words, when the record company wanted to raise the list price of his records. He was anti-Ticketmaster. He was anti-milking the fans. You know, there were not $350 golden circle seats at Tom Petty shows. And that's rare, you know, because you don't get it from Bono, you don't get it from Sir Paul McCartney, you don't get it from Bruce Springsteen. You know, and Petty was not one to take advantage of this loyal fan base.
Right. Jim DeRogatis, my guest in studio, one half of Sound Opinions, the greatest rock and roll talk show to have ever lived. You know, as we talk about Tom Petty, and of course, we're kind of, you know, talking about his legacy while he's still alive, and today was such an awkward, surreal day of of unconfirmed deaths, and you know, we're not even sure where we're at right now with him still in the hospital after being found unconscious in his home, cardiac arrest, being pulled off of life support, all the stuff that we know up to this point. As we talk about his career, one that just came through, when he came through Wrigley Field, what, last week, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Where does he stand? I mean, when you mentioned all those greats, Paul McCartney and Springsteen and the others, that U2, where does Tom Petty rank when it comes to the best rock and roll of a generation?
You know, it's interesting. I think, although he could sell out arenas like Wrigley, you know, to me, McCartney and U2 and Springsteen, those are arena bands. But Petty, even if he was playing an arena or the United Center, you know, he always made you feel like you were in the bar with him. And that's that, I mean, is a high compliment, you know, not as an insult. You know, there were no lasers and lights and gimmicks and no mid-set speeches about Aung San Suu Kyi, as you would get from U2, you know, and none of the fake, the reason I dislike Springsteen, none of the fake take me to the river, baptize me in the river of rock and roll stuff. Petty was meat and potatoes playing rock and roll. And I think probably the closest analog to any of the true rock greats is, well, there's two. You know, number one is Neil Young. You know, we forget that there are 150 Neil Young songs we love, and, you know, that the next album might be a complete turkey where he tries something weird, and then he makes one of the best of his career. He never stopped pushing himself. He never stopped growing, and he didn't care what you thought. And I think Petty had a lot of that in him. And then I saw a really moving quote that Bob Dylan put out. Obviously, Dylan was not yet aware that Petty was not dead, saying he was one of the best. And I did see Dylan play with the Heartbreakers, one of the Dylan-Tom Petty tours. And that was pretty phenomenal. Because Dylan also had that, I don't care what you think of me. Go ahead, call me voice of a generation, or call me a sellout because I did a Victoria's Secret commercial. He didn't care. You know, and I think the problem is that a Springsteen, a U2, a McCartney, they very much care, right? And I think Petty was in that. So, yeah, he's absolutely one of the greats, and he's all the greater for not having given a care about that.
Yeah. Let me ask you, you know, from your vantage point as a guy who's known Tom Petty and interviewed him and also reviewed his music, which Petty are you jamming tonight? What would be the Tom Petty that Jim DeRogatis is taking out of the old record?
You know, I think Wildflower is one of the solo albums, is probably my favorite start to finish. But I think, you know, tied neck and neck with Sheena Is a Punk Rocker by the Ramones, American Girl is quite possibly the best rock song ever written. It just is, you know. I mean, it's in terms of the yearning and the dream of what this music is, and it's personified in this woman, and that beat, that Stan Lynch beat. He had some problems with Stan Lynch, wound up out of the band. But, I mean, it doesn't get much better than that.
Yeah. Not too many people who are listening right now didn't scream that at the top of their lungs when the jukebox has that go on at any bar in any part of this state.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's just, you know, the last movie that Jonathan Demme made, or one of the last, Ricky and the Rockets, Meryl Streep plays a aging bar band singer, and she does a killer version of American Girl, which I think Petty would have loved. I mean, the fact that, you know, I don't think he ever strayed far from playing in the bar in Gainesville.
Yeah. Jim DeRogatis, one half of Sound Opinions, the greatest rock and roll talk show on earth, which you can hear on public radio stations all across the country and here in Chicago as well. And you know, a longtime reviewer, rock critic who's covered Tom Petty. Now, Tom Petty, not dead, as it's sort of been walked back by CBS and the LAPD. He today was found unconscious in his Malibu home. He was taken to, he had full cardiac arrest. He was put on life support, pulled off life support, and right now still in the hospital. So, Jim DeRogatis, thanks so much for joining us tonight to talk a little bit about Tom Petty and his legacy. Appreciate it.
You bet, Justin.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is coming to the Mack Center at the College of DuPage tomorrow night for a special event called The Man Behind Spotlight. Michael Resendiz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the Boston Globe and part of the Spotlight team that investigated child abuse and cover-up at the Archdiocese of Boston. This story, of course, was the source material for the Oscar-winning movie Spotlight. Resendiz was played by Mark Ruffalo in the film. The award-winning reporter has a tremendous career at the Globe and continues his work there. He's also an avid runner, and he was near the finish line when a bomb went off during the Boston Marathon. He'll be at the Mac tomorrow night talking about Spotlight, his career, but also about his profession, which is under attack as fake news for many Americans. On the line with us tonight, Michael Resendiz. Mr. Resendiz, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure.
You know, before we get into, because there's a lot I want to talk to you about, but you were near the finish line at the Boston Marathon when the bomb went off. And I just thought about what happened in Las Vegas last night and the idea of being witness to such horror. You've been in that predicament. That experience, what are people going through who were involved in such mass tragedy?
Well, I think what happens to people who are involved in very violent tragedies where a lot of people die is every time something like this happens, they're re-traumatized. They have to suffer the same experience over again. So that's really what's at stake for people who are victims in these situations and survive. You know, they keep having to re-experience it every time something like this happens. There is a difference, I think, between what happened in Las Vegas and what happened in Boston, as far as we know. I mean, what happened in Boston was politically motivated.
Right.
The two brothers were jihadists. This appears to be incredibly random, what happened in Las Vegas, just incredibly inexplicable. Almost beyond human comprehension. And I think that's what's so troubling about it.
When you talk about being a reporter in those kind of situations, and I just think about the people who are on the ground in Las Vegas now who are trying to get all the information and answer questions that there may not be answers to, especially when you're talking about breaking news and what information's coming out. How difficult is it to be in that situation when the public wants all of the information and it's just not available?
Well, I think what happens is when you're reporting, the adrenaline is overwhelming and all your training and all your instincts just kick in. I mean, when I reported on the bombing of the Boston Marathon, I had just run 26 miles. And usually when you run a marathon, you've expended all of your energy. But I found that I had plenty of reserves. I worked till about 11:30 that night. So I think reporters do an amazing service in these situations. They have to act very, very quickly and be very, very accurate. And it's tough. But I think all of us are usually acting on pure adrenaline and pure instinct.
Well, Michael, you're going to be in town tomorrow at the Mack Center to talk about the special event called The Man Behind Spotlight. It is interesting because that movie, of course, won an Oscar. And, you know, you're played by Mark Ruffalo. I think about that story, and I think everyone has been, obviously, we lived it as a current event, but also as the film. When you do these special events and you come to different places that aren't Boston, how do you tell the story? Because it's a story that now has been told, both in film and of course, through your great reporting. Is it more reflective about what the experience was like to you, or are you going through the facts of the case when you get on stage?
Well, I try to make it relevant to the present day. I mean, what I love about the movie is it shows people how important the issue of clergy sexual abuse remains, and also how important investigative journalism is. I mean, I think in this era of fake news, it's an opportunity for me to tell people how valuable real news is, how valuable investigative reporting is. So I try to make it contemporary.
There's a great scene in the film. We've all seen it, but when Mark Ruffalo playing you is arguing to go to print with the story. And this is such an amazing shot because it shows the emotion and it shows that reporters are real people.
We got law. This is it.
No, this is law covering for one priest. There's another 90 out there.
Yeah, and we'll print that story when we get it, but we got to go with this now.
No, I'm not going to rush the story, Mike.
We don't have a choice, Robbie. If we don't rush to print, somebody else is going to find these letters and butcher this story. Joe Quimby from the Herald was at the freaking courthouse.
Mike.
What? Why are we hesitating? Barron told us to get law. This is law.
Barron told us to get the system. We need the full scope. That's the only thing that will put an end to this.
Then let's take it up to Ben. Let him decide.
We'll take it to Ben when I say it's time.
It's time, Robbie. It's time. They knew, and they let it happen. Two kids. Okay? It could have been you. It could have been me. It could have been any of us. We got to nail these scumbags. We got to show people that nobody can get away with this. Not a priest or a cardinal or a freaking pope.
How much of that is a real struggle, whether it's this story or other stories, of when it's time for a story to go to print? Make sure you've got connected all the dots and dotted the I's and crossed the T's. Like, when is it appropriate to, is there an emotion around when you're ready to unveil an investigative report, especially with such heft as this?
Well, one of the things I really love about the movie is it's so authentic. And it doesn't make us out to be heroes in every respect. I mean, we're portrayed as real people, as you can see. Sometimes we lose our tempers. Sometimes we go down blind alleys. Sometimes we blow the story. And all that you see in the movie. So that's partly why I think it's so fantastic, is it's so real and it's so authentic. You know, the question of when to go with a story can be a difficult one. I do like to have all the I's dotted. I do like to have the T's crossed. But also, when you've got it, you've got it. And particularly in a situation like that, I felt that the cover-up was the most important aspect of the story. I always tell people the Boston Globe Spotlight team did not discover clergy sexual abuse. Right. There have been several scandals before we came along, and there have been a lot of writing about it, a lot of great reporting on it. The thing that made our work so different is we discovered the cover-up. And so I think when we had that story, I felt that it was really just time to put it in the paper.
From the success of that story, both, like I said, with the current events and Cardinal Law, but also the movie winning an Oscar, does it make the job that you do with the Spotlight team and at the Boston Globe easier or harder?
I think in a sense it's made my job easier in ways I didn't really expect. I get a lot more tips now, for one thing. And people are calling me and emailing me with so many good stories, I probably could never hope to do all of them. So in that sense, it's made the job a little bit easier. Also, I sometimes find that people who might not have agreed to talk to me, I think the curiosity factor gets the better of them. They know about the movie. They know I was played by Mark Ruffalo, and it makes them interested in sitting down with me.
Does it also make your job harder in the sense that because there are more tips and more sources that are coming forward that you may not have relationships with, that you have to vet that to make sure that the story is right, or not to get into a particular story that might be a blind alley?
Well, the only thing that's a negative is I do get a lot of email that is kind of superfluous. I do get a lot of story tips about situations that I would never write about, because mostly everything I do has to have at least some connection to the Boston area. So if I get a call about a story that's very particular to something happening in, say, you know, Duluth, Minnesota, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, to give you a couple of examples, you know, if there's no connection to something that's happening in the Boston area, I'm probably just not going to do that story. So I do have to wade through a lot of that email. I mean, I call it the daily deluge. You know, I get up and there's usually a lot of email there that I have to work through. But I have to say, it's a very small price to pay, because it's been great meeting so many wonderful people. I do get a lot of great tips. And it's just been a whole new world in some respects.
Michael Resendiz is my guest tonight. He is the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the Boston Globe, part of the Spotlight team that, of course, the movie Spotlight was based on, won two Academy Awards. Part of what you're doing at the Max Center tomorrow night is not just talking about the work of Spotlight, but also investigative reporting. We've seen it both ways. We've seen part of America say we need to double down and invest in investigative reporting because that we need this right at this time more than ever. And then you've got another part of the population that says, no, all these reporters are fake news. There's an agenda to these investigations. This is not true and accurate. Where do you see investigative reporting right now when it comes to gauging the American public?
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. And I think we are in almost sort of a crisis here, because there does seem to be a group of folks who think that they're entitled to their own facts and they're entitled to their own version of reality. And that's both on the right and on the left. I'm being nonpartisan about this. I think the country has become so incredibly divided and people are so entrenched in their political, philosophical, and ideological beliefs that it's sometimes very hard to dislodge them with real, true information. And I think what has to happen here is reporters like myself, I mean, reporters who are dedicated to providing factual information to readers so that they can make informed decisions in a democracy, we just have to keep doing our job, and we have to keep doing it over and over and again until people understand which are the news organizations providing real factual information and which are the organizations that are operating with a political bias.
I wonder, does it make your job harder when you're talking about sources, because you can't really afford in this day and age, with all the political pressure that's put on from the White House and from certain sects of the population talking about this being fake news, that you can't get a story wrong. You know, there has been maybe mistakes made, or maybe a source turns out to have an agenda or something of that nature. Do you find yourself having more pressure on the work to make sure that the story is accurate and fair?
I mean, in a word, yes. I mean, it's more important than ever, for all the reasons you cite, that we all be scrupulously accurate. So there is a lot of pressure to be accurate. I think that's fine. I think we should be under pressure to be accurate. But you're absolutely right. It's a different environment now. I think maybe you saw the situation at CNN maybe six right. weeks ago, where two very, 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 very highly credentialed reporters had to resign because they got a story wrong. That's what the pressure's like here. You've really, really got to get it right. There's no question about that. If you want to draw the line between fake news and real news, you really have to be right.
And there's so much out there that there can be an argument made by, especially when you're talking about, I would even going back to Spotlight and the focus on the Archdiocese of Boston. I mean, a lot of authoritarian figures trying to discredit you, a lot of different angles that people will try to expose to contradict the reporting. There is a lot around the word truth when it comes to in trying to uncover it.
Yeah, that's really true. And we were really up against that when we were doing our investigation of the Boston Archdiocese, because Boston, as you may know, is one of the most Catholic cities in America. At that time, I think it might have been the most Catholic city in America, even more Catholic than Chicago. And also, there was sort of bad blood between the Globe editorial board and the Catholic Church, because the Globe editorial board was in favor of abortion rights. So the cardinal had been very critical of the Globe. So it was really incredibly important that we be scrupulously accurate. I think what we had going for us is our stories were based on the church's own internal records. And that showed people that what we were saying was absolutely true. What we were reporting was not coming from an anonymous source. It wasn't even coming from a credible on-the-record source. What we were reporting was coming from the church's own internal records. The other thing we had in our favor was 2002. This was the dawn of the internet era. There was no Facebook, and there was no Twitter. But still, people had started to use the internet in very large numbers. And what we did is we posted the records. We posted the documents that we were able to obtain along with our story. So people could read the story, and they could say, man, can that possibly be true? Right. And then they could go right to the document and see that it was, in fact, true.
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't seen the movie Spotlight or checked out the writing of the Spotlight team that's online, Boston Globe, you're missing out. Michael Resendez is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the Boston Globe. He's going to be on stage tomorrow at the Mac Center at the College of DuPage for a special event called The Man Behind Spotlight. Michael Resendez, it was a pleasure talking. Thanks so much for taking some time out tonight. We appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, Studio 435 tonight, the North 41. This is going to be fun. I can't wait to talk with these guys. They've got great music. Their stuff is so good. The North 41 will be playing coming up in Studio 435, which is our weekly showcase. There are guitars and keys and bass guitars. so many bass guitars in here. The band coming up here. They'll be on coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Good to talk with Michael Resendez. Yeah, and that clip, man, that Mark Ruffalo clip. I wanted to ask him the question. We didn't get there, but I wanted to ask him about whether or not, you know, he was satisfied with the Ruffalo performance, which won him a ton of awards, nominated for an Oscar. But, you know, I just want to know what's it like to have a big Hollywood star play you? And our buddy Brian D'Arcy James was in that movie. He had the mustache. So, cool. Tomorrow night at the College of DuPage, Mac Center, Michael Resendez will be on stage presenting a speech, lecture. I think there's a book signing in there, too. So we'll talk about that coming up. All right. Like I said, coming up, Studio 435, the North 41. Tomorrow night, get a chance right here before we go to the break. Tomorrow night, I'm very excited. In the big table, Jan Brown is going to join us. Jan Brown is was the chief flight attendant for Flight 232, which was a flight that crashed in Sioux City, Iowa in 1989. What makes this flight and the story for many people who are listening right now, of course, know this story. But if you don't, It is one of the only times in air history where there was a crash of a DC-10 where there were survivors, and she was one of the survivors. She'll tell the harrowing story, which is being retold in a play at the House Theater's doing that Chopin. But she'll talk about her experience and take us through what happened at Flight 232 in Sioux City, Iowa, back in 1989. She's my guest tomorrow night on The Download. Don't miss that. That's going to be great. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back in studio tonight. The North 41. Stay with us. All right. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. Thanks for that news break, Rob. It's time for Studio 435, our weekly segment that showcases the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, the funk, rock, soul sounds of the North 41. Chicago Outfit's latest album is called Dancing and Praying, but they got a new single out. It's called Living on Top, which is a signal that new music's on its way. They're playing November 16th at Lincoln Hall, right here in Lincoln Park, right by DePaul University. They've been featured from WXRT to performing live on Windy City Live. They're in studio tonight. The band members, Riley Patrone, Frank Minella, also known as Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, and Donnie Brown. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So let's talk about this. You guys, the band, I mean, I love the music. The stuff is great. I love the sound. Where's it come from? Because Chicago is known. It's always had a sort of a really great R&B soul scene. What is it about your music that fits into that?
I kind of feel like we're just all got old school funk type influences, and a lot of it stems from that. And Donnie over here is a big player in the church scene. That definitely adds a lot of soul to our sound. Mm-hmm. And
I think just getting people up and dancing is important to us. You know, at our shows, we like to keep the energy high and keep the people dancing.
What is it about that sound? I mean, when we talk about the old soul sound, or even, I mean, I was watching some of the clips on your site, and you guys do some Rick James as well. I mean, talk about like, where, what is it? What's the sweet spot when it comes to playing that music?
It's a feel-good thing, man, to be honest. If it don't feel good, you ain't gonna move. You know, and I feel like Chicago, out of a lot of places, will let you know that, man. I done seen it a lot at shows. Like, some guys, you know, it's not the right feel, or it's just like the beat isn't coordinating with how your body's moving. It's just an all-around... When you got that
it's a vibe.
That sound, it's a vibe, man. It's that sound. Once you get
a scene.
That real good feel in your body, man, and it just make you move some type of way, that's how you know, man.
Okay, well, it is a scene. You mentioned it's a scene. I mean, talk about that scene, because there's a lot of bands that we've had come through here, whether it be The Congregation, mm-hmm. Oh My.
J.C. Brooks and the Uptown
Brooks,
Sound.
Uptown Sound's been on the show.
Those are our boys.
Yeah, so talk about that. Where is that scene fit in here in Chicago? Because Chicago's known to have a great hip-hop scene right now. It's also got a great rock and roll scene and alt country. Where are we when it comes to bands, more sort of funk bands?
People like to get down. Always. It never dies, the feeling.
Yeah, I think it's definitely going strong. I can't think of... There's, like you just mentioned, pretty much all the bands that are doing it.
Man, you got the Herd coming out, coming straight out of Chicago, man.
Just a lot of good funk music.
Where do you guys...
Spark, man, like, oh my God.
Where do you guys... Where do you congregate? Where's the venues in Chicago that are going to house a band like you guys? Because I saw you at House of Blues. You play that kind of stuff. But
Lincoln Hall.
Lincoln Hall will do that?
That's our spot.
Yeah, we love Lincoln Hall. That's our favorite venue.
And that's where we'll find that kind of music on display? Because I think of Lincoln Hall, a lot of artists that come through here do a lot of indie rock stuff like that.
They have all kinds of music.
We've done a few nights, funk nights, Church Booty, now known as Faye Ray, played with us. A good funk band with horns. Who else?
Nasty Snacks.
Nasty Snacks.
Oh God! Forget about Nasty Snacks. Those guys are great.
And we're putting on a show coming up. It's gonna be funky. We got Joe Hurler.
Basically anywhere, you know. We just like it as long as the room is cool. the fans come out and dance, and Lincoln Hall is just especially cool because they've got just a beautiful setup, and and the disco ball really helps with our.
Where does the I mean, you all have to share an interest, especially when you have a big band like this, in the same kind of music. I mean, I say funk, rock, soul, but where are your influences
coming
from?
Steely Dan, rest in peace, Steely. Walter Becker.
Dave Matthews.
DMB.
Stevie, of
Michael
course.
Jackson. Yeah,
throw Michael Steve Jackson.
Michael Jackson for sure.
What, right away, I'm like, what an array, you guys. You just mentioned Dave Matthews.
Frank Zappa.
Michael Jackson, Frank Zappa, and Steely Dan all in the same
Riley.
Breath.
And
Riley has
Carl
been called
Carlton.
The white James Brown.
Carl Carlton.
James the white Brown, Bruno Mars.
Too, man. Some Bruno, you got everything.
Bruno Mars is...
Every man.
Well, let me ask about Bruno Mars, because maybe that's a good jumping off point when it comes to the bands that are making the crossover into more popular music, the stuff you're going to hear on Kiss FM, that kind of stuff. Bruno Mars seems to have cornered the market when it comes to that kind of music, soul music, funk music. Live band, kind of stuff with the band behind him. Is that good for you guys as an independent band that are coming up? Or is that the kind of homogenized, sort of packaged top 40 music?
I feel like, personally, Bruno Mars gives me hope because he's just, like, the music is so good.
It's definitely
and
opened
like,
that door.
The musicians are
top notch.
And
they took it back to the, like, actual instrumentation and just that sound. It's, like, old school sound. So, it's like, okay, well,
the vibe is there
to
I think
a popular level.
I don't think we're trying to go for the top 40 style, just lyric-wise and package-wise, like you said, but we're definitely vibing off of that and going, creating some deeper art with a similar aesthetic.
Well, you mentioned some of the bands, even when you guys were throwing out, and after we went through the first the iteration, you got to some of the lesser-known bands. But when you think about funk, and I've known enough funk bands in my time, whether it be the Ohio Players or... Mm-hmm. Even the Brothers Johnson and the late 70s kind of funk explosion that even Funkadelic and the bands like that, they had a sound and a place, meaning they were very, very popular and they've been able to sustain careers even to this day. George Clinton travels the world and continues to perform. But there wasn't necessarily a crossover, meaning that you didn't hear necessarily Chaka Khan's probably not a good example, but a Rufus song being played in rotation. So the question being, like, is that where you guys are looking to be in that long history and that legacy of those kind of bands that I just mentioned that really were able to perfect a funk sound, but not necessarily a sound that was crossover?
I think we're more crossover, just because we definitely branch out and. A lot of our music does have like a pop vein, but it's super funk influenced. So,
yeah. Do those bands that I mentioned to you, like, do they bring up anything in you guys? Like, I mean, are there certain styles of funk that I'm crossing? I'm crossing the streams when I mention all those bands at the same time.
Well, definitely, I think in our song called "The Funk," it's definitely on some George. Some George Glenn, some Parliament and Funk type feel type stuff, man. So, I think
we're
deeply rooted
right
in the funk, but
we're doing it all.
We're crossing over, man.
We got the deep tracks, and
we even got some ballads.
You gotta have some ballads, right?
Yeah,
we're sensitive guys.
You guys are a regular little gap band. Which one of you is? Which one of you is Charlie Wilson?
Doug over here.
Good. All right, the band in studio tonight, the North 41, a funk band, also rock, soul, but they're a Chicago outfit. They have a new single out called Living on Top, which is, we'll talk about the new single, we'll talk about new music that's on its way. The band is Riley Patron, Frank Minella, also known as Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, and Donnie Brown. They are playing on November 16th at Lincoln Hall. We'll take a quick break here. We'll come back, and we'll get some live music at Studio 435. Stay with us. October 9th, Monday Night Football is on WGN-TV. Bears-Vikings kick off October 9th at 7, following WGN-TV Sports Monday Night pregame, 6:30. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's time for Studio 435. This is, of course, our weekly segment that showcases the best live music Chicago has to offer in our Allstate Showcase studio right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. All right, in studio tonight, the North 41 giving us the funk. Chicago Outfit's latest album, Dancing and Praying, but they got a new single out called Living on Top, which means we're going to have some new music. We'll talk about that coming up here. They're playing at Lincoln Hall on the 16th of November. The band members, Riley Patrone, Frankie Lightning, we'll just go with Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, and Donnie Brown. All right, guys, what are we going to hear here?
This one's called The Funk.
This one's called The Funk? All right, here's The Funk on Studio 435, the North 41.
Thank you.
Should have learned. Yeah! There we go! The North 41 with the funk in studio tonight, Studio 435. They're playing at Lincoln Hall coming up on November 16th. The funk band, of course, a new single out called Living on Top, which we'll talk about coming up here after the news. Riley Patrone, Frankie Lightning on guitar, awesome guitar. Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, Donnie Brown, band North 41 in studio tonight. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get Rob's news, and we'll come back with live, more live music here in Studio 435 with the North 41. Stay with us. This download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. It's Studio 435 time. It's our weekly segment that showcases the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight's no exception here in our Allstate Showcase studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. We've got the North 41, the funk band. That's, oh, man, that last track, the funk, was great. We're going to hear some more here. They just put out a new single called Living on Top. They're playing at Lincoln Hall on November 16th. The band members, Riley Patrone, Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, and Donnie Brown. You guys, what are we going to hear here?
This one's called Everybody Knows.
Everybody Knows, the North 41. Take it away, guys. Take me away from here. Yes, there we go. The North 41 in studio 435 tonight here on 720 WGN. Oh, my God. Good stuff. There we go. The funk band, their new single, Living on Top. That was Everybody Knows. All right, so bring you guys, come on back around the table so we can talk a little bit more. Whoever wants to talk. The band, Riley Patron, Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, Donnie Brown. They're playing at Lincoln Hall coming up on September or November 16th. They've been featured everywhere from XRT to Windy City Live. Like I said, they have a new single, Living on Top, which tells us new music's on the way. I mean, you were absolutely right. You know, we talked right at the top of that with the interview just about a feel. You know, and that song is a good example of, I mean, it's really hard not to kind of get into the vibe and just kind of stay there. I mean, when you guys are writing music and deciding to put stuff up on a set list when you guys are playing somewhere like Lincoln Hall, I mean, is the idea to just try to develop a set list that just kind of keeps somebody in the same place throughout that entire hour plus that you guys play?
We like to try to keep it, like, upbeat and all that, but sometimes we try to, you know,
we take it different places.
Go through a full range of emotions, mm-hmm. a journey,
yep.
an emotional
bring it
journey.
Through a journey.
Yeah,
but it all comes back to dancing and grooving,
having a good time.
Yeah,
we're gonna put a set together where we are gonna go up there and have fun. It's just
it's
addictive. Seeing people have fun. It's fun.
That was a great vibe in the room.
Riley, I mean, your vocals, I mean, are just outstanding. I mean, what a combination to put this music together and your vocals. I mean, where did you learn to sing like that? And I don't mean sing, you know, you're obviously a tremendous singer, but just that style, the style that you bring to this music, where does that come from?
Just comes from feeling good. Like I said before, I never really took lessons or anything. I just, you know, played with my cousin and all my friends growing up, and you know, we're just so tight. We've been playing together for a long time.
He's a natural singer.
Just get out there and...
It's actually funny. His, before he joined the band, Riley joined the band, it was me, Pat, and Frank, and we were a jam band with no vocals at all.
And it was terrible.
Then Riley joined, and it changed our songwriting.
He used to play bass.
The songs changed from long improv jams to something to fit Riley's style. Like when we sat down to write, it was thinking of Riley's voice and thinking of him, his moves on stage and the vibe that he creates.
When you guys are writing songs that way, especially as a unit now and you're coming out with new music, is that how you do it? To write to Riley's strengths, to be in a position where you have that kind of weapon in your arsenal to be able to play this music?
We all write We write pretty much on our own and bring it to the table after it's done. So I know for me, I'm thinking of Riley and like how he's going to sing it for sure. Definitely.
Okay, so let's talk about the new music because you got a new single, Living on Top. What can we expect, from more music, whether it be an album or an EP, but also what is different about the music that's coming out than the music that you've done before?
For me, I think the biggest difference is just really the sound. Like, it just, to me, it sounds so much higher quality than our first CD. Not that our first CD is bad, but I think we took it to another level, and like the production value is really great.
We have experience in the studio now, so
definitely we tried to work in some different sounds too, like synthesizer and even some drum machines.
Well, you know, we mentioned. I mean, I want to bring in Frank because you know. Was we at the beginning of the interview, we talked about, you know, how this all come together. What sound are you going? You guys say, well, you want it to be upbeat, you want it to have fun, but there's something about both of the guitars in the music, as you hear, that you're able to use the pedals and the sound to really give it a distinct funk sound. What is that? That sort of wow, wow, wow that you guys are both doing, and you as well with the solos to take a real rough sound and incorporate it into this music. It does stand out. It does make you guys not just a funk band, but that's where the rock comes in and you're able to carve out your own distinct sound.
Yeah, I think it just comes from the rock roots. Like me personally, I grew up listening to like a ton of classic rock and stuff. So
Jimmy Page
is my guy. That's why I have a Les Paul.
And all the Waka Wakas, that's just me rocking the wah pedal. Jimi Hendrix influenced, you know. Definitely all the funk bands use it too. it's a big part of my sound.
All right. The second question I've had just watching one of the videos, are you guys going to get on a boat again? Is there any more boat videos? Yeah. What song was that?
More to come.
That was Living on Top.
That was the new single? Yeah. So I hope there's more boat themed videos coming out.
We have a boat shoot coming up this January.
Actually, a boat calendar is going to be out.
A lot of flowing Hawaiian shirts on that. Check that out at your website, North41.com.
Shoes.
Yeah.
The boat calendar.
So
Donnie's on March.
We mentioned obviously the Lincoln Hall show coming up on the 16th. As you guys start to release that music, what's the plan? I mean, do you head out on the road? Do you just work locally? What is it that we can expect from North 41 moving into 2018?
We're hitting a lot of college towns and, you know, working the local market as much as we possibly can. A lot of it's been, like, opening for national touring acts and stuff like that. And then we do our own show like every couple of months where we do like a big blowout where we're the headliner. Just out here grinding.
All right.
You know,
I love it. Riley Patron, Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, Donnie Brown. They are the band, the North 41. They're playing at Lincoln Hall coming up on November 16th. All right. What we'll do here, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll play one more song and we'll get you guys out of here for Studio 435. The North 41. Stay with us. All right, there we go. It's Studio 435 here on the download, 720 WGN. In studio, the band, the North 41, the funk band. Their newest single, Living on Top, is out. They got new music on the way. They're playing at Lincoln Hall on November 16th. They are Riley Patron, Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, and Donnie Brown. We heard two great funk songs. And if you go to their album, which is out, Dancing and Praying, The Living on Top, the stuff that's coming out, you can get much, much more of that. Tonight, you know, we got a lot of great funk stuff, and we thought tonight, especially since the circumstances today surrounding Tom Petty, who is on life support in the hospital, or off of life support now, not dead, but fighting, that you guys would pay tribute. What do you guys got here?
We're going to honor Tom and send our positive vibes with Last Dance.
Mary Jane's Last Dance.
There you go. Mary Jane's Last Dance. The band North, the North 41 for Tom Petty here on the download. Take it away, guys.
Time. kitchen's down on Market Square. She's standing in her underwear, looking down from the hotel room. Nightfall will be coming soon. Oh, my, my, oh, hell yeah. Honey, put on that party dress. It was too cold to cry when I woke up alone. Hit my last night, I bumped to the road.
Outside too for that. Oh, you guys, thank you so much. The North 41 in studio. Look at that. A little Tom Petty just to take us out tonight. The North 41, of course, playing at the Lincoln Hall November 16th. Funk band, their new single, Living on Top. They got new music coming out and playing a little Tom Petty tonight for the end of the day. And we appreciate that, you guys. I know that you guys put that together at the last minute. So unbelievable. You guys are tremendous, tremendous band. Riley Patrone, Frankie Lightning, Patrick Walsh, Michael Campo, Donnie Brown, and Doug. Doug, the whole time, I just heard Frankie go, "Take it, Doug." And I'm like, there's a Doug in the band? So I apologize, Doug, that whole time. Great keys on the keys. I can't thank you guys enough for being Studio 435 tonight. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, Patty Vasquez. Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Coming up tomorrow night, and a great show. As I mentioned earlier, Jan Brown, who was the chief flight attendant on Flight 232 that crashed in Sioux City, Iowa. One of the only plane crashes in American history where there were survivors. And she will talk about that harrowing experience on the show tomorrow, 8 o'clock. We got a great show tomorrow, so I'm looking forward to that.